Tuesday this past week, four Harvard chaplains walked into Sacco's. Sacco's, the Candlepin Bowling Alley in Davis Square. Two evangelicals, one humanist slash atheist, and one Lutheran. One of the evangelical chaplains said that this was his first experience with candlepins. The Lutheran enthusiastically shared her preference for candlepins over regular bowling because in candlepins you get not two but three tries. For her money, candlepins was a game of greater grace, an experience approaching unconditional love, which launched an extended conversation among the chaplains between turns regarding the merits of competition versus unmerited love. Isn't that what everybody discusses while bowling? The humanist atheist was especially invested in this conversation, sharing that he had been raised with the understanding that love was something that must be earned. But since the birth of his first child about a year ago, his understanding of love changed radically. When his infant son reached for his finger and held it with a grip like no other, he found a love that was for him unconditional. The Lutheran chaplain resisted an urge to launch into a not-so-quick sidebar on a favorite image used by Luther to dismantle any notion of works or free will. The drowning individual who, when offered a tree branch to grab, grabs. I resisted that sidebar, but I did share my own experience that one did not have to grow up in a secular household to get schooled on love as something to be earned. From my own experience in a church-going family, love was not only something that had to be earned, but good luck with that, because humans were hopelessly flawed. And I added that in part, in large measure, I became a pastor after discovering as an adult that unconditional love was what Jesus was all about, the central message of Christianity that more often than not got buried in practice. Hearing about God's unconditional love, especially as an adolescent, would have been incredibly helpful for me. As a pastor, maybe I can do my bit to lift that up. Who won the game? The second evangelical chaplain, who had played candlepins before and was most energetic in defending the virtues of competition. Unconditionality of love comes into focus in the starkest terms in this morning's reading from Luke chapter 6, which begins, "I say to you that listen, love your enemies." And ends, "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven." Preaching on this passage over the years, I have taken what I can now acknowledge as an easy way out. An easy way out for me, but probably unhelpful for those who sit in the pews. I have told stories of heroic love and forgiveness, not gleaned from books, but from people who shared their stories with me eye to eye. A speaker in a Lutheran gathering in Worcester, Joseph from Liberia, spoke of being terrorized by the army of Charles Taylor. In the course of the attack, Joseph was forced to witness the execution of his two-year-old son. To that soldier, Joseph said, "I forgive you." Years later, Joseph spearheaded an organization dedicated to the re-education of the young men who had, as children, been made into soldiers by Charles Taylor. A man seated beside me on a bus between Santa Fe and Albuquerque, Gabriel. Gabriel was a teenager in Lebanon when he witnessed his father's death at the hands of a militia of Muslims. Gabriel and his family were Christians. All of Gabriel's peers, he said, were assuming that he would join the Christian militia and exact vengeance. Instead, Gabriel became a teacher and chose to teach in poor Muslim communities. Most recently, in the last couple of years, traveling in Israel in the West Bank, I've met Israeli settlers and Palestinians who would not say exactly that they were loving each other or even forgiving each other, but they were committed to what is probably the beginning of the path in that direction toward reconciliation. Namely, they were committed to seeing each other and then listening to one another. 2 years ago, I shared the story of being on the border of the West Bank and an Israeli settlement, being in an organization called Roots, which is an ongoing experiment where Israelis and Palestinians engage in dialogue. I did that in a sermon 2 years ago. A year ago, two of the leaders of Roots, Rabbi Hanan Schlesinger and Shadi Awad, were right here at UNILU to share with us how that work was going. And I recall that Shadi Awad was asked the question about how he viewed the pace of progress toward peace. Shadi, who is in his 20s, was not optimistic about any resolution in the near term, in the next several years, maybe in his lifetime. Reflecting on his commitment to dialogue in spite of such pessimism makes me wonder if that might be the love of the sixth chapter of Luke. That may be what it looks like. Now, I said telling these stories is easy for me and possibly unhelpful for you, and here's why. For me to tell a story and tell it so that you can see it is what I do. I'm pretty much a one-trick pony in that regard. More importantly and less helpfully, you may first find such a story inspiring in the way that heroic acts can be inspiring. But applying that heroism to oneself is a reach. I could never do that, is what I've heard from honest voices at the door on the way out of church, to which I might have answered honestly, well, the odds that you or I, as white, privileged, highly credentialed Christian citizens in the United States of America, living in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the likelihood that we will be called upon to exercise that level of love of neighbor is remote. So what if, as white, privileged, highly credentialed Christian citizens in the United States living in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you and I are the enemies? Remember, as the gospel writer frames this string of teachings by Jesus in the sixth chapter, love your enemies comes right after lamentations for the rich. In last Sunday's sermon, I tried to employ what I look back on as a fairly tortured metaphor field of blessings and bedbugs. And I think I might not have been clear enough that the bedbugs The ones who eat their fill at the expense of others are us. It was an unforgettable sermon. I shouldn't even bring it up, except that in Luke's audience in the late first century and in Lutheran assemblies in the United States for the past few centuries, the gatherings are made up of many of the most privileged in society. In our case, middle class and upper middle class white people. You've heard me say this before. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is the second least diverse denomination in the U.S., second only to the AME, African Methodist Episcopal. But here, and I really mean here, is good news for University Lutheran Church, because we are in a laboratory where we can learn that we are enemies and we are blessed and even loved unconditionally. And when we claim the unconditional love of Jesus as more than a transaction and even more than a gift that we receive with no strings attached, when we receive it as the location for our entire existence, then we can address what leads us to be identified as enemies. I bet some of you can't wait for me to get back to candlepin bowling. It was more fun. Claiming God's unconditional love makes it possible for such love, available always to us, for facing hard realities. When UniLu became a partner in the Cambridge Interfaith Sanctuary Coalition, whether or not we knew it at the beginning, we put ourselves on a collision course with the hard realities of our privilege. The collision might have been avoided or indefinitely postponed to our detriment had not the students God sent to lead us been the children of Latin American immigrants, that is to say, brown. There's a book that just came out, and I know a few of you have picked it up. The title is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. It's by Robin DiAngelo. Practically speaking, talking about racism is easy to avoid in the absence of people of color, people you know by name, people with whom you have shared more than one meal. It's easy not to talk about when nobody calls you out. But here at UniLu, from the beginning of the formation of the coalition, Gabby Chavez, Nestor Pimienta, and Alfredo Garcia have not only been leading us, but when need be, calling us out. On one level, we were receptive as we were warned not to see ourselves as saviors of whomever would come to seek sanctuary under our roof. During the first training for those who would volunteer to be in the sanctuary taking shifts, we were played an audio recording made by a Latin American woman who had been in sanctuary in a church in Colorado. And she was most articulate about how that experience felt. She talked about what it was like to suddenly have a crowd of well-meaning strangers in her life, all of whom had their own opinions about what she needed and voiced them as if she were not in the room, as if she were invisible. And hearing that, I remember thinking at the time, We will do better. We are quick studies. We will learn and avoid these behaviors that diminish, silence, or erase others. And I know now how overly optimistic and how very white of me to have believed that. Overcoming racism is not accessible in a training or in a course or in an academic discipline in which one may receive a terminal degree. Racism is a sin. It is bondage, as in we are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. In the January 2nd article in Christian Century, Carolyn Helsel writes about this. Estranging us from God and one another, racism, she says, perpetuates a bondage to sin where white people act out of habituated responses. Despite individual intentions. Grasping this, I'm learning, is the first step, and it is a step as wide as the Grand Canyon. Over the course of the past 2 years, in meetings of the steering committee of the Sanctuary Coalition, and in individual interactions, we of the coalition, we white people, are finding ourselves called out. I am finding myself called out by Nestor and Alfredo. And the first place I go, at least in my head now, is to my own defense. I see what you're saying, but that was not my intention. My first impulse is to justify myself, to try and put lipstick on the pig. But there is an alternative. I can take my defensiveness to the foot of Luther's Theology of the Cross, Heidelberg Disputation, 1518. These two sentences sum it up. A theologian of glory calls evil good, and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it is. On that ground, where the cross of Christ casts its shadow, unconditional love is present in abundance. In abundance for the sake of all that happens when enemies begin to be loved. Getting called out by a person of color, especially by people you trust, know, and love, on their part is exceedingly generous. To wake up black and brown in the United States is exhausting. To add to that burden, waking up white people? Here is what I'm learning. When feedback is offered that my behavior is being experienced as silencing, diminishing, hostile, or injurious in some way, first, I need to listen. I need to listen without formulating a response in the process. I need to simply listen as deeply as I would want someone else to listen to me. And then I need to remember that what I intended does not make a difference. What matters is the outcome in the relationship of the behavior, how it got received. And then refrain from non-apologies like, "I'm sorry if you were offended." True apologies are more difficult. True apologies that acknowledge the pain that's being experienced and recognizes that for the bringing of feedback costs the person delivering it, and thank them for that. Next, take responsibility and out loud speak a commitment to a path of change, and then follow that path. Now, what I've been describing is that after acknowledging pain, each of those next steps will take tremendous energy, prayer, and time. More than a training, more than a course, more than a bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degree. It will take longer than that, and you know how long that takes. Being one who is normally a quick study, confident in my ability to master the steepest learning curve, is not an asset. Here in this context, it is arrogance. Whatever I have considered humility in the past, I now know is not nearly enough. To that end, to the widening of my capacity for humility, I'm going to study White Fragility, that book, pairing it with readings on Luther's theology of the cross. I'm going to do that during Lent. It sounds like a good time for expanding capacity for humility. And anybody who wants to join me in that reading and conversation is welcome. Logistics to be determined. And until then, I am counting on this blessing. This blessing I speak for me and for all of us together. May we be so loved when we are the enemy that we come to know the true power of God's unconditional love. Amen.